Welcome to Cognation. I'm Joe Hardy.
And I'm Rolf Nelson.
On this episode, we're joined by Manesh Gurn. Manesh is currently finishing up his PhD in neuroscience at McGill University and has authored over 20 scientific publications on psychedelics, brain networks, and related topics. He collaborates closely with some of the leaders in psychedelic science and will join Dr. Robin Carhart-Harris at UCSF as a postdoc in August 2023. Manesh is also chief research officer at the Canadian psychedelic bioscience company Entheotech Bioscience and runs a YouTube channel and Instagram page called The Psychedelic Scientist. I highly recommend his YouTube channel. He does some really great explainers on some of the topics in psychedelic science. And yeah, he's just really good there, which is part of why I wanted to have him on the show. I thought you'd make a great guest. So thank you, Manesh, for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much. My pleasure. Excited to chat with you guys.
We talked about, you know, just having a pretty broad-ranging conversation on the neuroscience of psychedelics. And, you know, this is a very exciting field right now. There's a lot going on. Particularly want to talk about how our evolving understanding of the neuroscience of psychedelics impacts the way we think about treatment and the use of psychedelics in psychotherapy and other related, you know, treatment modalities. And we want to take a paper that you've written recently as sort of the guiding document for the conversation. The paper is A Complex Systems Perspective on Psychedelic Brain Action.
Yes.
So I thought maybe I could start by just asking you to kind of, at a high level, talk about what was sort of the thesis of that paper. What's the big idea behind that paper?
For sure. Yeah. And I can get into that by first describing the motivations, why we decided to write this paper, where the ideas came from. And it came from two distinct, you could say distinct streams of research. One is psychedelic brain imaging research. And a lot of people might have heard or maybe not about how psychedelics can make the brain more integrated and how they can disintegrate certain brain networks, such as the default mode network. And that's usually how it's portrayed in the media. It's like either the brain turns off this particular network related to our sense of self, related to our concepts and internal dialogue, and frees up the brain to be more integrated and share more knowledge and between different, you know, systems of your brain.
So some listeners might be familiar with the idea of the default brain network and maybe other brain networks like the salience network. Maybe just want to take a moment to describe what those mean and
okay, yeah.
Yeah, like what is a brain network in this context? Yeah.
Okay, exactly. For sure. Let's back up a little bit. Okay, so that thing in your head is called the brain. No, I'm just kidding. So the brain can be separated into distinct regions. Each region has a distinct function, you could say. It does something might be specialized for, you know, converting the light that hits your eyes into a visual scene. Some of it might be more related to language processing. Some of it might be linked to sense of touch. And so we can separate the brain into a whole variety of regions which do different things. And interesting thing about these sets of regions is that they seem to group into clusters of sets of regions which interact more with each other than they do with the rest of the brain. And so you can separate, let's say there's 50 regions in the brain, and 1 to 10 is the first network, and then 11 to 20 is the second network. And these are networks because they're networks, like sets of different regions, which tend to share information with each other, interact with each other more, and like work in a coordinated way towards shared functions.
Right? So we'd see these as, or at least my familiarity with these might be also like Jerry Fodor's idea of modularity of mind, that you've got these informationally encapsulated modules that sort of defines their isolation from other modules, and then they might be interconnected as well.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. It aligns with the idea from cognitive science of a partially decomposable system, right? It's like there's modularity, there's different modules, but they're more connected within themselves, but they're also connected to each other to some extent, right? And so you have the set of networks, which communicate with each other, but can be separated. And
then the default mode network specifically, maybe you can describe what that has been shown to do, because these things are, I mean, I think they're old hat for some neuroscientists, but they're relatively recent in the long history of neuroscience.
Yeah, totally. And so the default mode network is this particularly interesting one because, one, it consists of regions that are most expanded in humans relative to other primates and which are involved in these kind of human-defining aspects of our thinking. So default mode network is involved in a whole variety of processes, including our ability to daydream and mind wander and think about things that are not here physically in the here and now, to reason and think about the mental states and beliefs of other people, and also our ability to kind of construct a self-narrative and say, you know, these traits, this story, this is all me and that's not me, and it links to memory. And then more broadly, it's involved in our ability to imagine new experiences, plan for the future, and also remember past experiences and several other things.
And this has been linked with psychedelics before. What's the connection?
Right. Because, I mean, there's two ways we can go about this. So one is, it's like, if you think about what I just described, all these functions of thinking, of mind wandering, daydreaming, imagination, clearly that's altered when you take a psychedelic. You know, just experientially, subjectively, these basic aspects of our thinking and how we conceptualize ourselves in the world are altered when you're under a psychedelic. And so on the basis of that, people just kind of inferred that very likely your default mode network is being disrupted. And then the research, to an extent, has confirmed that or supported that. And it started in a 2012 paper, the first ever modern functional brain imaging paper on psilocybin, the compound in magic mushrooms, where they found that the default mode network, out of all networks, showed decreases in activity, meaning this network is like less active, which in some way you can understand is like a disruption of the normal way it's functioning. And so, and then people kind of ran with that idea. It was popularized in Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind, really, really emphasizes the default mode network. And other work has also found changes to the default mode network. But I should say, and I was going to get to this, is that basically every network in your brain is altered. Default mode network doesn't seem to be special in the sense that all networks are disrupted in their activity to some extent and become less integrated. And it might be the case that the default mode network is related to specific aspects of the experience, but this actually hasn't been consistently shown in the research yet either. We just have strong hypotheses. So the short answer is, yeah, default mode network is involved.
Just sort of in reference to this idea that it's happening not just in the default mode network, but it's happening all over the brain. So this, you're thinking of this as more of a you know, sort of a complete sort of state change for what's going on in the brain rather than just localized in any one particular state. And maybe that's an introduction to have you start talking about the perspectives of this paper and some of the findings that have gone into your thinking about this.
Yes, definitely. And so as I was just saying, the default mode network is involved in so many things, right? So to reduce a psychedelic experience to just a default mode network is not very, like, it's more complex than that. You can't just reduce it to one network. And what really struck me was how there's really large reductions in default mode network activity in a whole variety of contexts. You get it with MDMA, you get it with SSRI, antidepressants, you can get it with alcohol. As you get older, your default mode network has become disintegrated over time. That's a very common thing. And so there's a variety of situations and contexts where this similar pattern of activity in the default mode network happens, but the experience related to it is radically different, right? So then we can't just say, oh, when the default mode network is like this, it means you're in a psychedelic state or your ego has been dissolved or something like this. Like, we can't say that.
So it's very hard to map on that subjective state or any of those subjective states to a particular brain state. I mean, that's a general thing, but I think,
yeah,
maybe especially.
Yeah. If we break it down a bit more, like, when you take a psychedelic, when anybody takes a psychedelic, you're not having the same experience, right? Like, each person in the same room, same environment is going to have a radically different experience. And even you as an individual, if you take it today versus tomorrow, it's going to be a very different experience. And so then how can we expect one pattern, one brain state or pattern to reflect that? It's like, doesn't really make sense if we assume that the brain is mapping onto our subjective states, which we have all reason to expect it is, right? And so in this paper, we're saying kind of basically the idea that rather than seeing psychedelics as targeting particular brain networks or regions, we have to see it as shifting the fundamental ways in which the brain functions and processes information. And I think two good concepts to summarize this are the concept of criticality, and the concept of metastability. And so these concepts come actually from physics and dynamical systems theory, and also complexity science, which, just really quick, what that is, complexity science is a study of any network of distinct parts or any context in which something can be decomposed into distinct parts that interact. And you could think of this as an ecosystem. This is the analogy I like to use, because if you think of, let's say, a jungle, you have all of the plants that grow there. You have in the trees, maybe you have monkeys and birds. And on the ground, you have rodents, bugs, and all sorts of other animals. And, you know, the monkeys eat certain fruits, and then, but the fruits need the ants to do their thing to support it. And then the birds keep the rodent population in check. It's a coordinated system. Everything's interacting. If you pull out all the monkeys, it's going to mess with the entire system. The whole ecology is going to be disrupted, right? And so if you think about the brain in these terms, the brain is a set of regions where if you disrupt something somewhere, it's going to affect the whole brain, because the whole brain is so interconnected. And so if you really think of the ecology of the brain in the context of any process, really, I think, because everything will influence everything else to some extent. So underlying this paper is this concept of seeing the brain in this light, of like an ecology of brain regions, you could think of it. So these concepts, metastability and criticality, describe the nature of how a system like that, like an ecosystem or the brain, changes over time in response to changes, to perturbations. So it's like a perturbation might be to remove a species from the jungle, or in the brain would be to activate your serotonin 2A receptors, which is a receptor psychedelics hit. And I hope this isn't getting too technical, but
no, it's good.
So the idea is that psychedelics, by doing what they do to certain brain receptors, send cascades of changes throughout the entire brain, which change how the brain functions. And so I'll just describe criticality and metastability really quickly, because they encapsulate what it means. I'll start with the concept of criticality. So I'll try to make this as relatable as possible. So like, let's say when you're trying to function in your life needs to be a bit orderly and predictable. You want to feel like you know what's going on. You want to feel secure. And also your body and your mind wants to stay in homeostasis. You want to stay within a certain range of states of emotion and experience, so you're stable over time. You're not just full elation and then depressed and then this and then excited and sad. You don't, doesn't happen, you know, usually within a rather rapid pace all the time. And so the brain is in the business of keeping us within this relatively constrained world that works for us, you know. And obviously that could be healthy for some people, it could be unhealthy for some people, it could be connected to reality, it could be disconnected from reality, all these things. But the brain is trying to minimize the unpredictability of your experience in your life. And in doing that, it's keeping your brain a certain level of functioning. And so one way of understanding this, relevant to criticality, is that the brain can be more orderly or more disorderly or chaotic. It's like structure, order, chaos, disorder. And the brain usually operates at a good balance between these two. And where you need some chaos for not being super rigid, but you don't want to be super rigid. You don't want to be too chaotic, don't want to be too rigid. You have to find the balance. And so the idea is that the psychedelics push us a bit more to the chaotic side, to this threshold between pure disorder and order. And at that threshold, it's called the critical point. And we know from a variety of systems that at that point, it's the best for having a greater complexity of activity. So you're more flexible in responding to things. You're very sensitive to information that's coming in that state. And it's better for information sharing in the system. And so the idea is that psychedelics put in a state where the entire brain is more flexible, more dynamically changing over time, more sensitive to incoming information, and it's able to process it in a variety of different ways. And it's more integrated, which allows better information propagation throughout the system. Information is able to go from region to region. And so like this high level description encapsulates how the whole brain functions in the psychedelic state.
I love that description of chaos and stability too. I guess when I had thought about something like integrated information theory, which I think of as having to do sort of with the amount of information in a system and the entropy in a system. So just sort of reaching that point at which you can sort of have the most information in the system, which would obviously be a useful thing. reaches towards that point of chaos, right, where mm-hmm. it sort of extends out. So I really like the way that you explain it like that with the jungle analogy too. I think that's really helpful.
Yeah, cool. And I guess to relate that to sort of psychological functioning, right? The idea is that in the state that is slightly more chaotic, that is past that point of criticality or really, you know, in that direction, the idea is that there's an opportunity for a therapeutic opening, because when the brain is in that state, it's essentially more plastic, at least from a psychological perspective, open to change. So if there are rigid patterns in the way that you've been thinking about certain things, or there are patterns of thought that you have that are recurring, that are negative, deleterious, there's an opportunity to repattern those in a more positive way. That's mm-hmm. sort of the theory, right?
Yes, totally. Totally. It's allowing us to shift out of our usual frame and the usual constrained set of, mental states and experiences we operate in, and explore, new lines of thinking, new perspectives, and escape our kind of habitual ruts we might fall into in our mind.
So does this seem to you as similar to sort of like electroconvulsive shock therapy, where, that's, sounds a lot worse, or TMS in frontal lobe, where what you're trying to do, it's a little different, because what you're trying to do in those situations is stop perseverative thoughts or just kind of see something.
Rolf. I think there's something similar there, right? You're trying, both have this at this very gross level. I think the level at which this type of this theory and these sets of theories that you are sort of combining in this work, mm-hmm. really why it's becoming popular and more popular and why it's intuitive, is that it relates to this idea. It's almost like what you're doing with whether it be, TMS or electroconvulsive shock therapy or psychedelics, is shaking the snow globe, right? Mm-hmm. You've got some patterns that are kind of entrenched in the brain and ways of thinking that are entrenched, and you're basically shaking it up. Mm-hmm. I mean, right, at a very, very basic analogical level, right? That's kind of what you're doing.
Yeah, definitely. I think ECT, electroconvulsive therapy, is a bit more crude, obviously. You're just blasting the system. Whereas psychedelics, you're in this state, but you're still conscious. You're not strapped to a chair with muscle relaxants,
Usually. Like, more fun.
Hopefully. But and the thing with psychedelics is they can lead to insights, and when you're in that, this kind of shaken up state, well, you're still there. You're able to see things and have insights and process emotions and memories and stuff. That's really important.
Talk about that a little bit more, relationship with creativity too, because I think often we talk about creativity as having sort of a generative stage where you're trying to, think of as many things as possible, and then sort of starts out at divergent and then becomes more convergent, and that's when you sort of assess things and see what's going on. So how does this relate to what's going on under the influence of LSD?
Yeah, I think and actually wrote a review paper on psychedelics and creativity a few years back. We linked it to the generative and evaluative phases, and kind of the idea is that what we propose in that paper is that psychedelics are really good for the generative phase, right? They reduce our kind of rational constraints, they reduce our evaluative mechanisms, and allow us to entertain possibilities that might have seemed ridiculous otherwise, we just wouldn't have access to. And so I think for creative generation, just a volume of ideas and a kind of range of ideas, psychedelics can be potentially good for that, for the reasons I just mentioned. But also, it's like, just because you're making a lot of ideas doesn't mean they're all good or any of them are good, right?
Right. And you got to go through them afterwards and see what actually turns out to be a good idea and what was, totally. The light of day.
And interestingly, the research so far looking at it have actually suggested that creativity, in terms of divergent thinking, is more improved in the week after a psychedelic experience than acutely. Wow. So, and I think this could be a dose dependent thing. I think part of it is, especially if you're not somebody who's like a seasoned psychonaut who's like taken psychedelics many times, when you're in the psychedelic state, you're gonna have a hard time concentrating, focusing on what you're actually trying to think about, and these kind of generalized deficits in cognition and attention might lead it to be hard to think about creative solutions for a problem or something like this. Whereas afterwards, in the aftermath, you still have this lingering flexibility and openness of mind, which is called the afterglow effect.
And that's when it's a good idea to introduce sort of tested therapy and structured situations for that evaluative stage kind of.
Yeah, totally. Or even just to then try to engage in your creative process in that few days after. Seems to be very effective. Yeah.
Awesome. So I think we derailed you after you described criticality. I think you were going to talk about metastability.
Yeah. Right. So it all relates to what we're talking about. So this idea, I think it's very helpful for me at least to think of our brain and then our experience as kind of this space of possible places you could be, right? It's like you can be in a constrained box where your mind goes from here and there, but it's always within this small area. And with people with mental health conditions, or just not even like a condition, quote unquote, but like who struggle with some kind of thought pattern that reemerges, or some behavior that's very automatic that we can't escape from, we have a hard time escaping from, that our brain is like tending towards get certain states and getting stuck there, and it's unable to kind of get out, or it's staying in the same neighborhood of states, and it's hard. There's like a gravitation pull.
Local minima kind of thing, I guess, and if you were to describe it in mathematical terms, but I think your way is probably better.
Yeah, I mean, a way to describe it is like there's attractors in the landscape, right? There's like these gravitational pulls where you just always seem to end up in the same area of thought and emotion. And so the concept of metastability refers to this tendency to be able to navigate states very easily and like very easily switch between them. And actually, to the extent that it implies a state of a system where it never gets stuck in a given state. It always transiently kind of, as soon as it gets into that state, something about that state pushes it out. And so it's always alternating between different states, and you have this really big, great flexibility of mind. And there was some brain imaging research done by a friend of mine. His name's Parker Singleton. He did that at Cornell, and this was published in a journal called Nature Communications. And they found, using some sophisticated like data analysis techniques, that the brain actually seems to use less energy to transition between brain states in the LSD state. And it's just this more fluid ability to switch and share and switch into different configurations or states. And it goes hand in hand with metastability, which again is like, you can find it, you can understand it as you're stably unstable. That's a way to understand it. Like you have a stability in the fact that you're always switching between states in this fluid and easy way. And so
just a quick question here. So sorry, does this relate to, and I know there are some studies that show sort of suppressed or reduced action in parts of the brain from psychedelics. Do you think something like this might be at play there, where it's just lower energy, so it doesn't show up as heavy activity?
Oh, that's interesting. No, it's an interesting concept. It comes down to how energy is being defined. There's like what you're referring to is more maybe metabolic.
That's energy. What I was thinking of is metabolic energy, yeah.
And actually, this study wasn't metabolically based. It was based in the nature of the network, and it gets very mathematically. It's like graph theory applied to the brain and engineering concepts. It is an interesting concept. I wonder, like, does the brain become more metabolically efficient in a psychedelic state? I don't know. That's an interesting question. But it's this idea that the constraints on brain state shifting are relaxed a bit, and you're just switching between them. And so bringing this all together, it's like what we're proposing in this paper is it's more meaningful to describe the brain as entering into this more critical and metastable way of functioning, which is again conducive to flexibly responding to events that are going on, being very sensitive to what's going on, not getting stuck in usual patterns, and having more information sharing and integration. And what's interesting is that in complexity science, the science of these concepts, which again, it goes far beyond just the brain, they have a lot of quantitative metrics for characterizing these kinds of things, such as like entropy. That's an easy one. It's like how unpredictable is the signal, how much information is in the signal at each point. And measures like this, we're proposing, might be more useful in finding signatures of psychedelic brain effects that are common across people and data sets, and that distinguish psychedelics from other states more than looking at specific networks. So it's like, rather than looking at specific networks and patterns of brain regions, look at the nature or how it the whole network changes over time, if that makes sense. And that's us drawing from dynamical systems theory and complexity science, which are more kind of closer to physics sometimes, information theory, to help describe, again, the whole brain under psychedelics.
Well, I guess one of the ways to think about this, you know, is sort of summarized in your paper. And I think I just want to read a couple of sentences from this, because I think it kind of really captures intuitively, you know, taking a step back, higher level perspective on what's going on here. So psychedelics are known for their ability to induce potent subjective effects that vary widely across individuals and across experiences for a given individual. Assuming the existence of a direct mapping between the dynamics of subjective experience and the dynamics of brain function, it is reasonable to expect that this subjective variability is mirrored by neural variability. And this kind of gets at what I was saying before. It's like, taking a step way back, we all sort of have this intuition. If you've done psychedelics, or if you've observed anyone on psychedelics, or if you've done any research in the domain, that something is getting shaken up in the system, that things are getting in some way chaotic. Mm-hmm. That seems like a very intuitive description of what's happening subjectively when one takes psychedelics. And so then if there's this idea that it maps onto some sort of chaotic state or set of state changes in the neural systems, then it's intuitive. Mm-hmm. Now, that is, I like that. And that's what I really like about this approach. It also makes me nervous. Mm. It makes me nervous because we're talking about things at very different levels of analysis. Like your point that your analysis is coming from information theory and, you know, complex systems theories approaches. And what chaos means or entropy means in those systems is not necessarily the same as what we mean psychologically, right? The fact that they feel similar is what's kind of compelling about the theory, but also makes me a little bit nervous, just because when you see these things that are so kind of like, they're appealing at that level of, you know, taking a step way back, 30,000 foot view, but there's no reason in principle why the concept of, you know, entropy at the neural level needs to map to something that feels like chaotic at the psychological level.
Yeah, no, I like that. That's a good point. It's interesting because we're using these as metaphors for subjective
states.
They're
metaphors.
They're metaphors at the end of the day. And yeah, it just comes down to how hard it is to describe internal states, right? You can't quantify them. You can't, well, you can try, but it's usually pretty to use proxy measures, and it's not what we're actually trying to measure. It's harder to operationalize, right? And so, yeah, that's why these things are compelling as intuitive metaphors to help people understand it. But yeah, it's we have to remember that they are. It's like, just because, yeah, as you're saying, it's because the brain activity is entering these different states, and like, yeah, it makes sense that then you're mentally entering different states. But these are whole different realms of explanation here. And I think part of it is the need for more refined subjective measures, right? We need better ways to capture the moment-to-moment variability of the psychedelic experience subjectively, which is extremely tough. And I know Robin's very interested in that. And we actually have some stuff planned at UCSF getting at that a little bit more, and a very, you know, starting simple and then working way up. But it's very difficult, because if you ask somebody what you're experiencing, you automatically disrupt that experience. So like, how can we find something not too disruptive, find a way that's not too disruptive for somebody to report on a regularly, you know, every 5 to 10 seconds or something, at least to get a sense of that variability. And that's, yeah, I don't know. It's a difficult question, right? It
gets you in your head too. If you're doing that, you're making those responses.
And, exactly. Yeah.
Well, there is something that does seem plausible about that connection. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's kind of an empirical question. I mean, if you do the right experiments, you should probably be able to find out what the correlation is, or, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and Rolf and I were just talking earlier before the show about how you might use, like, psychophysics, for example, to get at some of the ideas of, you know, the role of, say, entropy, you know, at different levels of the system, based on how different types of visual patterns, for example, are distorted or not distorted, based on what your priors are about those things. If you can create a system, a psychophysical system, where you have an idea about like whether someone should have a prior about something visually. Mm-hmm. So it's something they see all the time, a natural scene or something like that. There should be some prediction about the distortion of that relative to another type of pattern that is not so, doesn't have those higher level priors so established.
Right, right. Yeah, that's really interesting. That's something I'm quite interested in, because that evidence suggests that that's related to the default mode network. And my PhD dissertation is actually on the default mode network more generally as well. And so it's a really interesting concept. Yeah, how it disrupts how our own like perceptual filters or how we organize experiences. And here's an interesting thing. You may know this. You probably heard of the binocular rivalry task, right? Where you, in each eye is a different image. And when you give that to somebody, your brain is trying to settle on an interpretation. But what it ends up doing is alternating between them. It doesn't, like, one might be a triangle, might be a square, right? And it goes square. And then at some, you know, periodic kind of rate, it switches between them, probably related to some kind of rhythms in your brain, some frequency power. But with psychedelics, there was a study that found that it was like an overlay of both those images. Like it was just stuck at one overlay. It wasn't alternating.
That is really interesting. I mean, that's a great experiment that matches up some of these, some of these subjective experiences to what's going on in the brain. I like that.
Yeah. We talk about like a meta stability kind of thing in perception, right? Yeah. I think that's why I use that.
Like a winner take all network kind of thing where.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was unable to converge on a, you know, on a winner for some reason.
It's like you see the duck and the rabbit at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. It was more the case after psilocybin, in that study. It was really interesting. But it lends support to the idea that our ability to organize our experience based on our priors is being altered. So that's cool empirical evidence for that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Let me jump to another question. You know, this one is about consciousness, and I hope you don't mind jumping into that territory too.
Yeah, yeah.
But
have some fun.
So, it's hard to measure consciousness and, you know what we're talking about. But, you know, some attempts to operationalize this, like integrated information theory or Bernie Barr's theory, think of this as when something is conscious, that it's widely available through the brain. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of spread, and that information is accessible by, you know, everywhere else. What does that say about a state of mind where you just sort of have more integration, really?
Yeah, yeah. It's an interesting question.
In a sense, I mean, that almost suggests conscious.
This is what the theory says, right? It's like you're more conscious on psychedelics.
Yeah, yeah, right. That's what.
Right. I mean, if you take it to the logical extreme, right? If you take this metaphor to its logical extreme, right? Yeah. You're actually more conscious on psychedelics.
Yeah, totally. And like, there's been research applying IIT, like integrated information theory, kind of metrics to psychedelics, and they find that there's more information. It's a quote unquote a higher level of consciousness according to that metric in psychedelics relative to normal wakefulness. And so you are getting more informational integration. I think intuitively it corresponds to people's experiences of having really rich subjective experiences where a lot of latent aspects of their mind, their memory, thoughts are now disappearing. And so I think it all checks out. It's somehow creating this greater informational complexity through the integration and dynamics as well. And this opens up the level of information and consciousness and the richness of things we're experiencing.
And there is some evidence on the flip side, right? Where some relating back to your theory, where in the unconscious state, this sort of the inverse is happening, right? Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, definitely. And there's actually, I just mentioned information theory and metrics showing that psychedelics are higher in complexity. But if you look at coma, vegetative state, it's on the other side of the spectrum, right? And so that's like the extreme from rigid to chaotic again, almost. It's like in the sense of informationally low versus informationally rich. But of course, if you get too chaotic, then it becomes informationally low again because it's just randomness. Hence the criticality where you need to find that balance. But it's this interesting spectrum, and then it's cool to try to map other states onto that spectrum as well, to see where they stand.
Cool. Well, I mean, I guess one of the questions that comes up for me is, things to just talk about with regards to your paper you're really pulling together a few different threads of theories that are out there. Do you want to talk about that? Some, how some of the existing theories of the neuroscience of psychedelics are sort of integrated by this work?
Totally. So the one that comes to mind the most is the Rebus model, which is the relaxed beliefs under psychedelics model. And we've kind of been implicitly talking about it a little bit. And so this model basically proposes that through their effects on the serotonin 2A receptor, that psychedelics disrupt brain processing, particularly in the default mode network, that's related to encoding our kind of beliefs and assumptions and expectations about our experience, our priors, as you might call them, like our prior beliefs and expectations, you could say. And by disrupting them, they kind of free up information that we had previously been explaining away or that weren't in our model of how the world is and who we are. Because we created this idea of certainty of this is how things are, but that can never be complete, right? It has to be constrained. And then when that's disrupted, we start to realize all these things and remember things that usually didn't fit in before. And that this process then allows us to change our beliefs and assumptions and our priors to be more inclusive, perhaps, or more healthy. And then when you go back after the experience, you have a new set of expectations about yourself and your life. And this dovetails a lot with this whole thing of the whole brain becoming more flexible, dynamic, a bit more chaotic, perhaps. And because it's a shakeup of our usual models of reality, which constrain our reality. And so I think in that sense, it aligns with this Rebus model idea of relaxing our beliefs, relaxing our habitual ways of filtering our experience. So then they could be revised in new ways. So that's the Rebus model. Another popular model is the thalamocortical model of psychedelic effects. And very briefly, this is the idea that, let me back up. So there's a region of brain called the thalamus, which one of the things it does is it takes information from our senses and then sends it to more advanced parts of your brain. And in doing this, it kind of filters it. It's a filtering mechanism to prevent us from being overloaded by our senses, let's say. And the idea here is that some of these psychedelic receptors are in the thalamus, and they influence how the thalamus gates information, and that it leads to a kind of influx of more information. So the cortex, a more advanced part of the brain, gets overloaded, and this leads to kind of a, you know, too much information being spread, and this makes the brain more interconnected, dissolves boundaries, and can lead to ego dissolution, this kind of stuff. So linking that to this complexity science perspective is the idea that through this increased information, sensory information flowing into the cortex, the brain is like pushed to have to respond to it. And so these network changes, integration, its flexibility is in some sense, to some degree, related to this influx of information coming in that the brain now has to deal with. And that what we're seeing is a greater sensitive information is just a greater openness and less gating of information. So that's, how can we do that theory?
That's great. No, and I love that. I love that this work kind of is pulling these pieces, these threads together and doing it in a very intuitive way. It's nice. I mean, that conversation makes me want to think about the role of set and setting and therapeutic context and the use of psychedelics, because I think implicitly behind some of what we've been talking about, you know, is this idea that there's a big movement right now to use psychedelics as medicine to assist in therapy or just to be medicine on its own. And one of the implications of the model that you're talking about is that, you know, with this increased level of, chaoticness, if you will, in the brain through psychedelics, very different outcomes can occur depending on what the initial state of the system is. Mm-hmm. And there's an opportunity to affect the initial state of the system psychologically by this so-called set and setting. And so maybe you could talk a little bit about that, you know, in the sort of contextualized around therapeutics.
This concept that the brain is the way it functions has changed, I think, aligns very nicely with the concept of set and setting, right? Because the concept of set and setting basically just tells us that how our experience is going to go is based on the factors that are at play in that moment, or like that you're bringing to the experience. It's not creating something, it's catalyzing or activating what's already going on and already the information you're already perceiving. And for that reason, obviously, like your mindset, your expectations, your emotional state, and then your environment, the sensory information you're getting, the social information you're getting, are going to he's thrown into this new way of brain functioning, and that's what leads to your unique trajectory of your experience. And so then, you know, theoretically, one thing we can do is if we're able to separate different types of people based on their baseline brain functioning, using complexity metrics or whole brain metrics, we can then maybe separate different types of people and have some level of predictability, ability to predict which trajectory they're going to go on after the experience. Are they more likely to venture into states associated with challenging emotions and fear, or mystical states and bliss and this kind of thing? And so I think looking at whole brain patterns in non-drug state and using that predict drug whole brain patterns is a really interesting way to go. And there's actually a lot of research, for example, depression, where they like scan like thousands of people's brains under depression, and they're able to isolate different subtypes based on their whole brain activity. And then, you know, imagine being able to say like, oh, based on this depression subtype, you know, a psychedelic in this context might work for you, or this psychedelic, you know, ketamine is even better for you, MDMA better for you, based on their brain subtype. And you can make inferences based on receptors and where they're located. Like, there's a lot of potential there. And so I think it's really interesting avenue for predicting effects as well.
I have another question too, which is, so you're doing research in Canada right now. I think you have some experience or knowledge of you know, research that's going on in other countries because you've been doing a lot of collaborations. So what's the regulatory environment like right now, using psychedelics in research and sort of availability and, you know, difficulty and, mm-hmm. you know, and getting this research going? Because I mean, it has opened up somewhat, but certainly not available to everyone to research.
Yeah. Definitely. It's still quite difficult. And honestly, Canada's a bit behind on it. I think Europe, there's a lot more research. There's like full-blown research programs at multiple universities, you know, at University of Basel, University of Zurich, Maastricht in the Netherlands, Copenhagen, and then in London as well.
Where there's a lot of buy-in that this is an approach to go for.
Yeah, there's a lot of funding. Like, there's full-blown research programs that get through ethics, you know, boards, pretty easily, and is able to do a lot of experiments that really wouldn't fly here yet, with healthy subjects looking at mechanistic non-therapeutic stuff, which I find the most interesting a lot of the time. There's a lot of that in Europe, and in the States there's a fair amount too, like at Hopkins, John Hopkins, and also now UCSF, and there's research, you know, at UCLA and NYU, and Harvard has their own thing now, and Stanford's making one, and it's kind of everywhere. But in Canada, there's some in McGill with rodents, and there's some human stuff related with ketamine that I know about. And I know there's some things on the way in Toronto at U of T. I think the main barrier is not necessarily ethics boards. It's more so funding. These studies are extremely expensive. You have to purchase the drug, which is very expensive because you get it GMP certified, high quality, and there's not that many companies, so the prices are quite high. Currently, there's not enough competition. And also, if you think about it, you bring somebody in and you give them a high dose of psilocybin. It's about 8 hours, 8 to 10 hours.
You have to be responsible right. for them for that whole time, right?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. And you need a physician, usually, who's there. You need a guide. And then you need all the support for 8 to 10 hours per person. And then you scale that up to 30 people. Then you add in brain imaging, which is expensive itself, usually 500 an hour-ish. And then it scales up to really expensive studies. And the federal government is not really... right, not much funding for it. So it's a tough time.
So where are dollars coming from, or dollars or Canadian dollars coming from for this?
So in Canada, it's usually, again, there's not that much work, especially in humans in Canada. There was recent, like, it's mostly through grants that PIs, like researchers already have, and they just kind of construe psychedelics as fitting under their existing grants, perhaps, mm-hmm. and finding a way to make that work. So that's one way to do it. But the CIHR, so Canadian Institute of Health Research, recently did a funding call where they provided $1 million for 3 studies specifically for psilocybin psychotherapy. And so that was a great development for the federal government, pouring $3 million into it. That was just that was last year that funding call went out. So that's showing a shift in federal funding towards it. But still, it's very hard to send a grant and get approved for it. And it's already hard enough to get grants. Now you're throwing psychedelics in it. It's like kind of, it really yeah. depends on what reviewers you get. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you guys are familiar with that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. And so I guess the situation is similar in the US, right? Like there's starting to be some funding. Is that correct? Or
yeah, but more than Canada, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. I think Johns Hopkins University really set a good precedent, and Matt Johnson down there just got a multi-million dollar grant through NIDA, which is, you know, National Institute of Drug. What does the A stand for? Anyway, it's maybe either of you know. Anyway, it's a major drug research, you know, federal drug research organization in the States, and they funded multi-million, multi-year study for psilocybin for tobacco addiction for smokers. Mm. And there's other grants and money coming in for other kind of research too. So I think the tide is turning. There's more federal funding being available in North America. And in the years to come, it's going to happen more and more as there's more safety data, as there's more reliable evidence that they're suggesting there are useful tools, you know, clinically, but also mechanistically in a more basic science way. And so I'm optimistic. And I feel like for me, I'm starting my postdoc in August. I'm coming in right at a good time where stuff is starting to take off. And let's hope it continues, which it seems like is happening.
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of the on the therapeutic side, there's different competing kind of frameworks. I mean, you could call them models, but really, I think it's more frameworks or approaches. You've got on the one side, you've got folks who say it's really inner work. When you take a psychedelic, there's healing that's happening often, as this story goes. But that's really done by some work that the person is doing internally or their brain is doing, right, without any kind of external therapy. So it's just you take the medicine and it's going to have positive effect because there's some sort of collaboration with the ongoing neuroscience of, you know, that's there. And then the other model is, you know, psychedelic assisted therapy. So you've got the idea is, well, you've created this plastic open state and now you need to apply something positive to that psychologically to like have the intended benefit because, you know, plastic states can go positive or negative or all kinds of different ways. Where do you come down on that?
Yeah, I think I do believe that psychedelics are inherently like neutral, relatively neutral, in the sense that it really depends on the context that you're in, you know, setting. It could take you in a very negative space, take you very positive. So, for example, people often joke like, oh, let's give, you know, Trump or some politician ayahuasca or, you know, put acid in their water or something and it's going to change the world. But I think it could just make people more narcissistic, more all these things, you know. And there's like people in the KK who get together with their KKK buddies and do acid together or do LSD together. I should call it LSD. Or do mushrooms together, and they don't come out of it saying like, oh, what we're doing is wrong. They go into it and go deeper into their group bonding with their peers, right? And so I think the context really matters, and this is where the psychotherapy aspect comes. It's like that plasticity and flexibility can, if you're not supported well, you're not prepared, can take you deeper into depression. It can destabilize you. It can re-traumatize you. That's why a lot of cases, especially if you're somebody with like some deep trauma or persistent kind of chronic mental health issues, you got to be careful. And really, this is why psychedelic psychotherapy is so, you know, there's so much in it. You're getting therapy beforehand, you're carefully supported during, you're supported after, you're given integration practices, concrete steps to take. I think all that is an important part of it. Like the therapy is an important part of psychedelic therapy. This is not to say that any recreational use is still totally reckless. I think it just needs to be done with care and preparation and respect and knowing that these things aren't just going to magically heal you. You need to really put in work before and after to really reap the benefits in a lasting way. Mm-hmm.
So maybe thinking of this in the exact flip side. So I don't know as much about it. And this is just history, but the weird LSD experiments, the MK Ultra was it experiments in the 60s were, I mean, they would be sort of the opposite, using LSD for evil, right? not for therapy, but some other sort of change. Does the effectiveness of those kinds of programs say anything about the potential effectiveness of therapeutic programs?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it comes down to behavior change, right? Behavior, like mental and behavior change. And I think, you know, combining psychedelics with a coordinated set of, I don't know, techniques, practices, interventions can synergize really well and create really powerful outcomes wherever those things are leading them, right? And so I'm not sure, you know, I don't think who knows, MK Ultra success in the end, like we don't really know.
Right, right. Yeah, we don't know. We don't know everything about all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I think it does suggest the power of these things as behavior change molecules and catalyst for personal transformation, which I do believe is possible with them, particularly possible with them when used in the right way.
And certainly, as you say, Joe, with the use of a therapist who guided something, guiding it.
Yeah, I think that's sort of where I come down on it for sure. It's like, you know, having some skillful guide or approach at least is extremely important and helpful in getting some benefit out of use of psychedelics. Mm-hmm. I guess that kind of brings up the other piece of this for me, which is, how do you think about the use of psychedelics over time? So, for example, in my own personal experience, the very first time I took LSD was absolutely transformative, you know, really changed my entire worldview and, you know, was a lot of the reason why I pursued visual psychophysics in my research, in my, you know, PhD training and things like that, trying to understand how the brain constructs the world around us. Just getting that sudden insight that actually the brain is constructing our perceptual world.
Yeah.
And to have that deconstructed in real time and being able to experience that was just absolutely transformative for me. And then, you know, the whatever nth time that you do it, that there's less of that. So I guess, how do you think about that in terms of use of, is it you get the message and then you put it aside or yeah, exactly. How do you think about that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it's very different for every person, right? And I think some people, they have one profound experience and they just never feel called to do it again. And that's totally fair. And that can be what that person needs, right? And again, it depends on the setting and what you're doing it, what your intention is. Because if, you know, people can do it many times and have fun and go to a festival with their friends or use it to connect. And I personally think there's absolutely nothing wrong with doing that. But I also, if you're using it in a therapeutic way, I think the danger is just chasing a peak experience. And so I think it's really important to emphasize that. What matters in the end is how are you showing up in your life differently? How is your every day to day? Are you really using, as you know, the phrase is using those, are you going from altered states to altered traits, right? Are you just pursuing these altered states over and over again? And so I think eventually for a lot of people, like you don't really need to do it anymore, except for in a more recreational fun context or as a refresher perhaps. But I think each person needs to find their own way to pursue it and be mindful of using it as a crutch or an avoidance mechanism or chasing highs, as opposed to using it as a means of real growth and transformation, you know, independent of the drug. But yeah, in the end, it's all to say it comes down to what somebody's intention is and why they're doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, we want to be sensitive to your time, so I want to ask you one last question, which is, what are you really excited about next? Like in terms of research directions or where, you know, the space is going or what you're particularly doing yourself that you're excited about? Like what gets you excited right now?
Yeah, totally. So like me, I'm really interested in effects in healthy people and like the concept of human potential and of growing beyond just being functional, right? Because like we have this slow pathology focused conception of psychology and everything and neuroscience medicine. Like, how can we just be normal, functional, and not unhealthy? But that's like setting the bar super low. There's so many ways we can grow beyond just normal adult functioning in a, you know, a capitalist neoliberal economy and being a good person in the machine to generate, you know, to push the economy forward. There's so much more to being human and so much more to human development that's been talked about by so many theorists and thought of stuff, you know, going back, you know, a long time, different cultures, etc. So with psychedelics, I'm interested because they are spreading the idea of personal transformation and growth. I think they're a mechanism for that and telling people that it's possible to radically change how you respond to and interpret life, that there are ways and avenues to actually get real healing. Getting those ideas into the broader culture through psychedelics and psychedelic research can have a lot of, I think, downstream effects, which are very positive. And so I'm really interested in the research, just further showing us or telling us or providing evidence for how psychedelics can mechanistically in terms of the brain and shift people into new ways of perceiving and relating to the world and conceptualizing themselves. And I think by providing more information on how it might be happening, it's more compelling to a lot of people. And then they're like, oh yeah, this actually makes sense because the neuroplasticity and the complexity and the flexibility, etc. And that could be really like a positive placebo for a lot of people in believing in their own growth. And so I'm quite excited about that. And that's why I like the mechanistic research and think it's really important to understand how, because that's, again, it's super compelling for people.
All right. That's great. I love that. I love that. Manish Gurin, thank you very much for being on the show.
Yeah, my pleasure. This is a lot of fun. Thank you, guys.